Fixing the System with Andy Farnell and Helen Plews. In this episode, Helen is reading from and analysing the work of Dana Meadows. She'll be reading from Leverage Points, Where to Intervene in a System.
Number 10.
Section 10, the structure of material stocks and flows and nodes of intersection, such as transport, networks, population age structures, flow of nitrogen through soil. The plumbing structure, the stocks and flows, and their physical arrangement can have an enormous effect on how the system operates. When the Hungarian road system was laid out so all traffic from one side of the nation to the other had to pass through central Budapest, that determined a lot about air pollution and commuting delays that are not easily fixed by pollution control devices, traffic lights, or speed limits. The only way to fix a system that is laid out wrong is to rebuild it, if you can. And Maury Lovins does wonders of energy conservation by straightening out bent pipes and enlarging two small ones. If we let him do energy retrofits on all the buildings of the nation, we could shut down at least half of our electrical power plants. But often, physical rebuilding is the slowest and most expensive kind of change to make in a system. Some stock and flow structures are just plain unchangeable. The baby swell in the US population first caused pressure on the elementary school system, then high schools, then colleges, then jobs and housing, and now we're looking forward to supporting its retirement. Not much that we can do about it because 5-year-olds became 60-year-olds and 64-year-olds became 65-year-olds, predictably and unstoppably. The same can be said for the lifetime of destructive CFC molecules in the ozone layer, for the rate at which contaminations get washed out of aquifers, for the fact that the inefficient car fleet takes 10 to 20 years to turn over. Physical structure is crucial in a system, but rarely a leverage point, because changing it is rarely quick or simple. The leverage point is improper design in the first place. After the structure is built, the leverage is understanding its limitations and bottlenecks, using it with maximum efficiency, and reframing from fluctuations or expansions that strain its capacity.
Response to point 10, structure. Dana's example of all the Hungarian traffic flowing through Budapest is an almost perfect description of the poor design of the internet today, a peer-to-peer system that has been shoehorned into a centralised and hierarchical monstrosity to pander to the commercial profit motives and to replicate incumbent power relations throughout the 1990s. You have traffic being routed through completely inappropriate ways across continents that it should never touch. We have now a broadcast system built to replace television transmitters, imposed upon the network by film, record, and publishing companies. The whole structure is twisted. It is delivering only a tiny fraction of the value to humanity that it could. It is also fractured, what we call the splinternet, the broken internet. That's partly a result of political friction and disintegrating international relations, but also of deliberately non-interoperable monopoly blocks. This example also shows that the rank of leverage points Meadows proposes isn't fixed. It changes with technologies. So, unlike Dana's assessment of connectivity as a low-impact leverage point, in the digital world, I would rank it as much higher. Because, unlike physical infrastructure that's expensive to change, digital networks can be restructured overnight. We can flip a switch and, if necessary, write a law to make that flip happen. And we can force a reconfiguration on the whole show in very short time. Yes, there are things like fixed undersea cables, but most of the problems come from logical connectivity.
So, a system is limited by its design from the start. If done correctly, it can be a fantastic leverage point. But the snag here is for all those listening who have inherited poorly designed systems in the first place, just like the Hungarian transport minister who commissioned the report that Meadows mentions. It must lead to thoughts of, it's too late, so I'll apply policy and wish for the best. But it's a serious issue. If your system was so poorly designed in the first place and it's complex, then it in itself is the problem. What if the system is fixed and unchangeable? With costs and times taken to fully redesign it, it does make it a weak leverage point. However, when we look at digital systems, it is far simpler to adjust and redesign small aspects, leading to an overall advantage of this leverage point. Resilience engineering and assessment can really aid here. The hours of painstaking labour into mapping the entire system and all of its interconnecting parts might just pay off by showing the areas where the system redesign is possible. If it's not possible to change the entire design of the system, maybe those sections highlighted can be and can continue to be improved upon by building in flexibility. Systems can be so messy that in some cases it is cost effective to start a new design and build from the ground up. Computer systems and networks do give us more flexibility to do that. After all, it's mostly servers, VMs, groups, policies, software, and users. It is not a population or a road layout. It can be recreated and redesigned to make use of the leverage point, but it is hefty work, so that decision should not be taken lightly without first proper assessment of the benefits. When designing almost any system, resilience engineering is vital for complex systems where there are intersecting elements that work independently. In conclusion, when designing a new system, take note of any leverage points in that system, use resilience engineering, and if you already have a system in place, it's well worth assessing to see if you can use leverage points within its system design. However, if you've inherited a system that is so messy that it cannot be redesigned, it might just be worth throwing it in the bin and starting again. Just make sure that you clear it with your finance team before you do so. When we create systems, making sure that we are aware of resilience engineering and proper system design in the first place, taking those extra steps to make sure that each intersecting part behaves correctly, can make the difference.
Number 9.
Section 9 of Meadows, the length of delays relative to the rate of system changes. Remember that bathtub on the fourth floor I mentioned with the water heater in the basement? I actually experienced one of those once in an old hotel in London. It wasn't even a bathtub, it was a shower. No buffering capacity. The water temperature took at least a minute to respond to my faucet twists. Guess what my shower was like? Oscillations, hot to cold and back to hot, punctured with expletives. Delays in feedback loops are critical determinants of system behaviour. They are common causes of oscillations. If you're trying to adjust a system state to your goal, but you only receive delayed information about what the system state is, you'll overshoot and undershoot. Same if your information is timely, but your response isn't. For example, it takes several years to build an electric power plant, and then that plant lasts, say, 30 years. Those delays make it impossible to build exactly the right number of plants to supply a rapidly changing demand. Even with immense effort on forecasting, almost every electricity industry in the world experiences long oscillations between overcapacity and undercapacity. A system just can't respond to short-term changes when it has long-term delays. That's why a massive central planning system such as the Soviet Union or General Motors necessarily functions poorly. Because we know they're important, we systems folk see delays wherever we look. the delay between the time when a pollutant is dumped on the land and when it trickles down to the groundwater, the delay between the birth of a child and the time when that child is ready to have a child, the delay between the first successful test of a new technology and the time when that technology is installed throughout the economy, the time it takes for a price to adjust to the supply and demand imbalance. A delay in a feedback process is critical relative to rates of change, growth, fluctuation, decay. In the stocks that the feedback loop is trying to control, delays that are too short cause overreaction, chasing your tail oscillations amplified by the jumpiness of the response. Delays that are too long cause dampened, sustained, or exploding oscillations, depending on how much too long. At the extreme, they cause chaos. Overlong delays in a system with a threshold, a danger point, a range past which irreversible damage can occur, cause overshoot and collapse. I would list delay length as a high leverage point, except for the fact that delays are not often easily changeable. Things take as long as they take. You can't do a lot about the construction time of a major piece of capital, or the maturation time of a child, or the growth rate of a forest. It's usually easier to slow down the change rate so that inevitable feedback delays won't cause as much trouble. That's why growth rates are higher up on the leverage point list than delay times. And that's why slowing economic growth is a greater leverage point in Forrester's World model than faster technological development or freer market prices. Those are attempts to speed up the rate of adjustment. But the world's physical capital plant, its factories and boilers, the concrete manifestations of its working technologies, can only change so fast, even in the face of new prices or new ideas. And prices and ideas don't change instantly either, not through a whole global culture. There's more leverage in slowing the system down so technologies and prices can keep up with it than there is in wishing the delays away. But if there is a delay in your system that can be changed, changing it can have big effects. But watch out. Be sure you change it in the right direction. For example, the great push to reduce information and money transfer delays in financial markets is just asking for wild gyrations.
Number 9, response, cyber delays. Organisations that get hacked don't know it for months or even years. When they do find out, they resist disclosure out of embarrassment. Take the latest UK breach of the electoral register, an incident the Commission concealed from the public for over a year. So, why did they delay? We need to work against pride like that. But one way to do it is that we need to work against techno-shaming. When you delay, it magnifies the impact massively. Delays, of course, are used tactically to profit. Asymmetrical bandwidth makes it very fast and cheap to upload your data to a cloud provider, but painfully slow and expensive to retrieve it when they hike their storage prices. It's very easy to sign up to contracts, but infuriatingly slow and obstructive to disengage.
Meadows was totally right in her assessment of monitoring systems delay. In 2023, we monitor absolutely everything with sensors, data science, IoT devices, monitoring and logging. Now every aspect of every single system is assessed for system successes, failures and fluctuations. It has reduced the delay in the feedback loop, but poor assessment is often done to work out how long the delay in that feedback loop should be. A modern example of this would be Netflix. It employed excessive data science and monitoring its successes, failures, and fluctuations of its television services. It was implemented to reduce feedback delays, which for a broadcaster and television producer is vital and incredibly costly, Knowing if a show is scoring highly with its watchers means they can decide to put more or less budget into that show. And more importantly, it means that they don't waste billions in a show on the edge of failure. So the savings on paper seem perfect. So the data science was expanded to reduce those feedback delays, but it was reduced too much. In fact, so much that a new show can barely complete its first season without some data scientists predicting its downfall. In the case of Netflix, the feedback delay is too short. It doesn't give time for word of mouth about a show, those reviews, or the press it creates to really get off the ground. So the data that's produced is not reflective of its success. And it's caused great anger with its users, so much so that they've quit the service in high numbers due to their favourite TV shows that they've invested a large amount of time in being repeatedly cancelled. This then led to international stories of a rapid drop in Netflix share price. Their feedback delay was just not long enough, and it did have a great impact. It truly is a leverage point, but can be a negative one if the length of delay is incorrect. Now, it's not a case of monitor and watch just every system. We now need to ask ourselves if we should, in terms of privacy. How long or short should the feedback delay be? And is it vital to continuation of operations? If we go back to the London shower incident, the feedback delay working at the right level will keep the shower temperature consistent, but too much too quickly could make it difficult for the user to make the correct judgments. Balance is vital, and getting the balance right with the delay length can have far-reaching consequences. There is a case here of too much gathered far too quickly.
Number eight, feedback.
Number eight.
The strength of negative feedback loops relative to the impacts they are trying to correct against. Now we're beginning to move from the physical part of the system to the information and control parts where more leverage can be found. Negative feedback loops are ubiquitous in systems. Nature evolves them, and humans invent them as controls to keep important system states within safe bounds. A thermostat loop is a classic example. Its purpose is to keep the system state, called room temperature, fairly constant at a desired level. Any negative feedback loop needs a goal, the thermostat setting, a monitoring and signalling device to detect excursions from the goal, the thermostat, and a response mechanism, the furnace and/or air conditioner, fans, heat pipes, fuel, etc. A complex system usually has numerous negative feedback loops. It can bring into play, so it can self-correct under different conditions and impacts. Some of those loops may be inactive much of the time, like the emergency cooling system in a nuclear power plant, or the ability to sweat or shiver to maintain your body temperature, but their presence is critical to the long-term welfare of the system. One of the big mistakes we make is to strip away these emergency response mechanisms because they aren't often used and they appear to be costly. In the short term, we see no effect from doing this. In the long term, we drastically narrow the range of conditions over which the system can survive. One of the most heartbreaking ways we do this is in encroaching on the habitats of endangered species. Another is encroaching on our own time for rest, recreation, socialization, and meditation. The strength of a negative loop is its ability to keep its appointed stock at or near its goal, depends on the combination of all its parameters and links. The accuracy and rapidity of monitoring, the quickness and power of response, the directness and size of corrective flows. Sometimes there are leverage points here. Take markets, for example. The negative feedback systems that are all but worshipped by economists, and they can indeed be marvels of self-correction as prices vary to moderate supply and demand to keep them in balance. The more the price, the central piece of information signaling both producers and consumers is kept clear, unambiguous, timely, and truthful, the more smoothly markets will operate. Prices that reflect full costs will tell consumers how much they can actually afford and will reward efficient producers. Companies and governments are fatally attracted to the price leverage point. Of course, all of them determinedly pushing it in the wrong direction with subsidies, fixes, externalities, taxes, and other forms of confusion. These folk are trying to weaken the feedback power of market signals by twisting information in their favour. The real leverage point here is to keep them from doing it. Hence the necessity of antitrust laws, truth in advertising laws, attempts to internalise costs such as pollution taxes, the removal of pervasive subsidiaries, and other ways of levelling market playing fields. None of which get far these days because of the weakening of another set of negative feedback loops, those of democracy. This great system was invented to put self-correcting feedback between the people and their government. The people, informed about what their elected representatives do, respond by voting those representatives in or out of office. The process depends upon the free, full, unbiased flow of information back and forth between electorate and leaders. Billions of dollars are spent to limit and bias and dominate that flow. Give the people who want to distort market price signals the power to pay off government leaders. Get the channels of communication to be self-interested, corporate partners themselves, and none of the necessary negative feedbacks work well. Both market and democracy erode. The strength of a negative feedback loop is important relative to the impact it is designed to correct. If the impact increases in strength, the feedbacks have to be strengthened too. A thermostat system may work fine on a cold winter day, but open all the windows and its corrective power will fail. Democracy worked better before the advent of the brainwashing power of centralised mass communications. Traditional controls on phishing were sufficient until radar spotting and drift nets and other technologies made it possible for a few actors to wipe out the fish. The power of big industry calls for the power of big government to hold it in check. A global economy makes necessary a global government and global regulations. Here are some examples of strengthening negative feedback controls to improve a system's self-correcting abilities. Preventative medicine, exercise, and good nutrition to bolster the body's ability to fight disease. Integrated pest management to encourage natural predators of crop pests. The Freedom of Information Act to reduce government secrecy. Monitoring systems to report on environmental damage. Protection for whistleblowers. Impact fees, pollution taxes, and performance bonds to recapture and externalise public costs of private benefits.
That's a great section from Dana Meadows, and definitely one of my favourites, where she gets more into the social and political reality of systems. In section 8 on feedback, Meadows makes a very strong point that I think we need to think about as information and security engineers. On one hand, all of our systems seem to work better with high speed and quality of information flows. Disinformation and disruption produce global bad effects. But at times it seems like, as security thinkers, we spend a lot of time slowing down and restricting information. Sometimes policy making turns into an angrier version of Moses coming down and reading out the Ten Commandments. And ubiquitous cryptography, though it's absolutely essential against the ever-increasing threats to privacy, also breaks the flow and general legibility of all communications, so dampening down our systems. So we need to carefully balance immediate security against a cumbersome load, one that fractures and impedes agile communication and action. Ultimately, as Meadows points out, at the level of system values like efficient markets and democracy, success of the system as a whole depends on free, reliable flow. Long-term security of a system
is the continuity of its highest values. So does that make all security into a trade-off between short and long-term security? It only does where we have a wholly negative idea of security, one that fosters ever more secrecy, compartmentalization, and mistrust. There are alternative, positive, and enabling perspectives on security. When battling against the noise, they are a way to make our signal much stronger. We might call these tools something like tools for conviviality, a topic I hope we'll return to in another episode.
You're listening to The Cyber Show. This episode is Places to Intervene in a System, from Thinking in Systems by Dana Meadows. Excerpted and edited for The Cyber Show by Andy Farnell. Read and analysed by Helen Blues.
As always, thank you for tuning in to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.